This is the third episode of the Sean Mo Hoops podcast, and I'm excited today to have an esteemed guest, Dinos Trigonas, here. Dinos is probably the preeminent grassroots hoops authority in Southern California, as well as throughout the U.S. I was able to meet Dinos a few years ago, but was well aware of all the camps he was running, and I'm sure I'm going to forget a few things because Dinos wears a lot of hats in the basketball universe, but he has his own website, fullcourtpress.net. He runs a very well-established AU team out here in Southern California, and he also puts on some of the best individual summer camps for players, as well as some of the top AU tournaments in the country. So, Dinos, how are you doing tonight?
Great, man. Appreciate you having me on.
Well, I appreciate it. So you have a pretty interesting background, and you've been involved in the grassroots high school and AU scene for a long time, but I was just kind of curious, you're a California guy growing up, you know, were you always a hoops junkie when you were a little kid and in high school, or how did you kind of get into this world?
Yeah, you could say that. I actually played high school ball at Woodrow Wilson High School in Long Beach. I was the first of three brothers to play there, and actually my high school coach had pretty good roots, basketball roots, both playing and being coached by certain individuals. His junior college coach was Lute Olson.
Okay.
His high school coach was the high school coach of Mike Montgomery. And Jim Ferguson was my high school coach. He played both at Long Beach City College, where I think he won a state title with Lute Olson in the early 70s, and later was recruited to TCU by a guy named Jim Killingsworth, who was a very good college coach, very respected during his tenure there. And that's back in the old, I think it was the Southwest Conference at that point. But he played in the year with Alvin Adams, who was the Phoenix Suns legend, you know, player coach, I think, as well. So, you know, and he was also good enough to be drafted in the fifth round by the Bulls back then. So yeah, I have a little bit of, you know, from a tutelage standpoint, guys that were connected, and you know, my brothers played. My youngest brother was on a Long Beach City College state championship team playing for Gary Anderson. And Gary actually also played for Lute at the same time as my high school coach, Jim Ferguson. Gary is the father of somebody you might know, Ricky Anderson, who played with Luke Walton and Richard Jefferson in Lowell Woods at Arizona. They lost. He was on that team. They lost in the finals to Duke and Jay Williams and Sean Bates, Shane Battier, and with Mike Dunleavy, Carlos Boozer. So we kind of have a little bit of kind of a hoops, strong hoops connection in that area. Long Beach, obviously, was a launching pad for Jerry Tarkanian in the late 60s, early 70s. And you know, Tex Winter, coach there. I actually saw Tex Winter coach as a young kid. Craig Hodges was among the best players to play for the Bulls with Michael Jordan. And actually, I also remember seeing a young sophomore from Michigan State named Irvin Magic Johnson come to the Long Beach Arena to play Tex Winter in Long Beach State back years ago before he got drafted in the NBA.
Okay.
So, yeah, I've been around the game for a long time and had high school teammates that played at a high level, and my brother went on to be a Division III All-American at Chapman in Orange County, California. So it's a little bit of a, you know, we were kind of connected in many ways. So that was kind of the beginning of my interest, and was very obviously Frank Burleson, who's still around, was covering the prep scene heavily for the Long Beach Press Telegram at that point, and Frank had. Was also back in the age of no social media, kind of was a source of a lot of information for us, both on a local, regional, national level, because he was connected to a lot of coaches and basketball sources. And, you know, he also attended a lot of McDonald's stuff in the camps, the ABCD camps, the Nike camps, the big tournaments, the USA basketball, Olympic trials and things of that nature.
Yeah, obviously Frank's a big name, and I didn't realize kind of the long line of history in terms of of Long Beach, you know, obviously a talented area, but in terms of all of those coaches you kind of came across, it's pretty interesting. But what, going back to high school,
one more thing. People don't realize that at one point in time, both Jerry Tarkanian and Lute Olson coached in the city of Long Beach. And Jerry was at Long Beach State. Lute was the junior college coach in town, which is kind of an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, no, so that was what, back in the
early
late
70s.
80s?
Early 70s.
Early 70s. Okay. Well, yeah, definitely, obviously, the kind of two of the top coaches, especially out on the West Coast during the 80s and 90s, and at Arizona and UNLV, and then Fresno State for Jerry. But you kind of had, you grew up in the basketball scene, but then after college, you went out to the East Coast to law school, which is something I didn't realize. But you know, how was that experience for you? And when you were kind of out on the East Coast, obviously, you know, away from what was familiar, were you always trying to get back into basketball, or what were you kind of thinking?
I went out to Temple Law School. My sister lived in New York, and decided to go to law school. And besides the educational component, it was a very, very good cultural experience for me, too, because I had my car out there. I had driven my car cross-country out there, and I was able to get around and kind of visit a lot of the historical sites that a lot of the locals probably take for granted, whether it's the Valley Forge or, you know, going down to Washington, D.C. and visiting all the national monuments and treasures and all the National Cemetery and all the battlefields and or going up to Boston at that time, seeing the old original Basketball Hall of Fame. And, you know, being able to, everything was so close. So able to get from a cultural standpoint. I also got a chance to keep track of the basketball scene in Philly.
Yep.
Was covered by the local papers there, obviously. It was a little bit different than the West Coast. It was kind of hard for me to understand it at first because a lot of the games were off limits to the public. In the public league of Philadelphia, I had to pose as a kind of a fake scout sometimes just to get into games to watch guys play, whether it was at Ben Franklin High School or other high schools. And I actually remember seeing a Philadelphia public city final between Simon Gratz. We had Rasheed Wallace, who was a 6 foot sophomore, 6 foot eight sophomore. You see, my recollection was he probably weighed about 120 pounds at the time. and they had a guy, and they had a real good point guard on that team. But also, they were playing Franklin Learning Center that had Tyrone Weeks. They went to UMass with Calipari and another kid, kind of a heavy set, undersized power forward for Ron Hams that went JUCO and then Utah State. I think he played for Larry Stacy at Utah State. So it was a high-level basketball and was able to kind of, you know, see Jerome Allen play in high school at Haverford and Lou Rowe, Atlantic City. So they were kind of, you know, follow the game a little bit there. So, but things kind of mushroomed when I came back home. And my youngest brother was finishing up. And the scene was much, much different then. Back then, only the top players, the all-state players, the all-city players, the all-regional players were players that played or were invited to play on club teams. There weren't that many of them compared to now. It was
right.
Very limited opportunity. So I had coached a team of unsigned seniors. So my brother, a guy named Mark Neal, who went to Long Beach City College and then went to South Alabama with Musselman's dad, and was a pretty good player there. And things just kind of started at that point, and the NCAA had kind of opened up the fall period, which a lot of people weren't doing events in the fall. I started one of the very first ones, and that kind of.
So when was that? What time frame was that?
That was 1993. That was about 1993. 1993. I graduated in 1992 from law school, came back, and then got obviously, I you know, Frank hadn't missed the beat. Frank was in his prime then. That was before the internet still somewhat. Obviously, we relied on Frank to put out the information, on events, because he'd have a weekly column that people would pick up every Tuesday, or see every Tuesday. And I'm not sure whether he mailed that column to the various coaches. It was kind of a different situation back then. Even the scouting services back then, from an invoice, you either mail an invoice or you would fax an invoice. Or if you were having an event that was open to college coaches, the normal mode of informing them was either through the mail or, for quicker attention, through faxes. So I can remember now my apartment, I'd be up all night faxing schools one by one, you know, information on the upcoming tournament, teams were going to be there, what time, if they were the schedule already done, that would be in there. It was a much, much more of a Pony Express process. Type of process that we have today. And actually, what's funny about it is still people still ended up getting the information, you know, even though it was done a little bit slower than we're accustomed to now, maybe not as instant, it still was effective. And it shows you also, too, that even though technology has gotten better, you know, people still found ways to get things done, whether you're a college recruiter like Tim Floyd, who obviously I don't think he's never had an email sent or received his whole life. or somebody else, and just the schedule was, you know, whether it was a college coach, I'll give you an example, the Slam and Jam NIT, which was run by the late Izzy Washington. I think Izzy just passed away this past year. And you would come to town and if you're a college coach, you would get the morning paper in Long Beach and read Frank's preview article and then get the schedule of all the games at 7 o'clock in the morning, or get it word of mouth from it was a little more dicier of chopped up as far as information. But the thing that was easier about it was you're dealing with less teams. So I think what we're having now with the speed of the information is because there's so much volume of it. Back then, when you had 40, 50, 80 teams at most, you pretty much could call every team and know what team when they were playing. So if you had a team called Team Moran, I'll call you about the coach at TCU, say, Sean, what time you're playing? All right, I'm going to call Dino, find out what time he's playing. I'm going to call H, open call to Magic, find out what he's. So they right. kind of pieced it together on the by phone, by, mail, all of the occasional fax. And then even the teams would have to wait to get their schedule in the mail, or for quicker response would call guys like Izzy or Rich Goldberg on the phone and find out what they're playing. You might not have the entire schedule for everybody until you got there, but at least you knew, when you were playing. So it was a little bit different, but looking back at it, it looks primitive. But at that time, it was the norm. It was customary. It wasn't really thought of as, it was what it was. And people showed up.
Versus, now, say the Fab 48 in Vegas, which was, this past summer was actually my first year going to that. But you're in Vegas and you have, I don't even know how many teams did you have in that over.
In the high school division, we had 500 teams, and just
500 teams all over the city.
Yeah, and then you have two other major tournaments going on at the same time that have their own volume of teams. And now you have certain guys like Ross Comerford with Fast Model, who's got an organizational app and organizational online tools to help. To help these guys organize what they're doing. Obviously, back then, it would be very problematic if the number of teams were the same without the technology to be able to disseminate, that much information in a short period of time. And again, going back to your going to a 40-team tournament, 40 to 80 teams, you may only be recruiting, you know, guys off 5 to 10 teams. It's manageable to track them by phone call, you know, or to try to find out. Now it's
right.
Nearly impossible to do that. You don't have the time to call all those teams. And or those guys could call the tournament organizer for who was playing when. But again, he's dealing with 40 to 80 teams, not 400 to 800 teams. So that's a big
yep.
difference as far as time consumption and ability to organize it in a way that's, you know, sane versus insane.
In terms of, obviously, you're running a lot of camps, but you mentioned initially you were, you know, you started coaching, so you got into that area. And, you know, you run the Belmont Shores AU program, which is obviously a very well-established program out on the West Coast and has produced a lot of NBA players. I definitely want to learn about how you got started, but to me, this was probably one of the funnier stories I've heard, but can we go back? I think it was, what, probably 2013 in the spring, and you guys are out in Arkansas for the Real Deal in the Rock tournament. And I remember you kind of telling a story of basically you had a few potential NBA guys, but you were looking for – you needed some extra players. So
do
you remember
– that was the Real Deal in the Rock, which had left the University of Arkansas, and then went to Little Rock, University of Arkansas Little Rock, and changed venues. Actually, no, I'm sorry. They actually changed because of the Division One rule.
Yeah, the NCAA.
They were using a four-court facility there in Little Rock. So anyway, it was a scenario where I had three really good players at the time. Two are now in the NBA: Tyler Dorsey with the Hawks and Daniel Hamilton with the Thunder, who's on a two-way contract this year, and Vance
yep.
Jackson, who signed with UConn out of high school and just now transferred to New Mexico State this year. We have free to play. But they had a scenario where I had a couple of other guys that were scheduled to come and that had issues. Maybe four guys had issues with either a combination of school, discipline, family issues, et cetera. And I kind of tried to replace these guys within the 2 to 4 day window, and I didn't have any luck. The other guys were already accounted for. There was nobody available. And we ended up going to this tournament, and we're scheduled to play the Atlanta Celtics right off the bat with the guard that went to Arizona. He went to the draft. He made a team. Braxton, but the guard for Arizona last year.
Oh, Kobe Simmons.
Kobe Simmons. But they were young men. And then we had Jahlil Okafor and Cliff Alexander the next day.
And those two guys back at the time, I mean, they were the, you know, the Twin Towers
yeah.
of Chicago. So
we go there yeah. with about five guys, and we had more adults on the trip than players. And I was trying to get some local players just to have some kind of some bench relief. And, you know, Archie Goodwin had come to my camp, and I had got to know him pretty well. I was trying to see if he had any cousins that were playing over there. And he tried contacting them, and they were already scheduled to play with other teams and striking out left and right. So we basically go down with five guys. I don't know what to expect. So we're driving down to the first game, and we were passing this park on one side of the road and see some kids playing, and they were in high school, pulled over, and we got a little surprised that we rolled up on them. They may have thought we were trying to drive by them or something. But they got a little startled.
If you guys are in one of those big kind of white AU vans, I'm assuming, and just rolling up to a playground.
Yeah, at that point, we might have had a 7th passenger with a door on the side. So the door, I asked Vance to actually slide the door open. So I kind of like screamed at the kids, "Hey, man, are you guys in high school?" He said, "Yes, sir." And I told him, "Get in." They said, "What?" I said, "Get in the car." I said, we're going to a game. I only got five guys, and I need at least two more. You two right there, get in. So somehow we were able to toss them in. They jumped in the car. I didn't even know their names. We get to the game. We play well, you know, our starting five. You know, Tyler was terrific, and so was Daniel Hamilton. And Vance had a great game, too. And we were up big enough to where I felt comfortable putting these guys in the game. And not only did I not know how good they were, I didn't even know their names. So they got in the game, and they actually weren't bad. They were solid. And in the middle of them playing, I remember John Stovall from ESPN coming over to the bench. He goes, hey, man, who are these two kids, number so-and-so, so-and-so? I don't see them on the roster. And Jerry Meyer happened to be sitting nearby near the bench. And I said, John, I'll be honest with you. You're not going to believe it, but I don't know their name either. He goes, what do you mean you don't know the name? I go, let's pick these guys up at the park about a half an hour before the game on the way here. He had some warm bodies. And they were laughing about it. And it was something. And they actually, one of them came back the next day. The other one had an SAT conflict. ACT or SAT conflict. And we ended up losing by one to Okafor, Jalen Brunson, Cliff Alexander. So
yeah, I remember. I mean, when you first told me that story, I was cracking up and definitely one for a good laugh. But you mentioned Dorsey and Hamilton, but you know, you've been coaching Belmont Shores for a while, and what going back to, you know, Trevor Ariza and a lot of other well known college and NBA guys, you know, in the world we're in and that really we've been in, the shoe companies, Nike, Adidas, Reebok, Under Armour, you know, what have you, they kind of tend to dominate. So how have you kind of been able to navigate the waters and still get really a lot of the top guys in the Southern California area?
Well, the one thing is Southern California actually compared to other areas has been a pretty good hotbed of talent. And there's a lot of different players, and not everybody is going to be a phenom coming out of high school or coming out of middle school in the ninth grade. So some come in with heavy accolades. Tyler obviously was well known in middle school, and Tyson Chandler was. Other guys like Baron Davis and Russell Westbrook and Kawhi Leonard were not. So
yep.
It's a matter of identifying guys that have potential and also trying to sell a different type of opportunity. I think a lot of times some people get caught up with the gear or the particular circuit, and they don't understand that it's the opportunity that's the most important thing, to be able to play minutes and develop, and to be able to be a focal point, and to be able to be around people that can have this connection with the college coaches, that can market you to the college coaches, so you can maximize your value to them. And some parents understand it, some parents don't. But there's been enough talent there to where I think there's room for independent teams to carve their own little niches. The LA Rockfish has done a very good job of that too the last couple of years. They have two guys in the Pac-12 right now, and Thomas Welsh and Robert Cartwright at Stanford. So I think it's a matter of being able to kind of focus on people that are kind of inclined to be attractive to things that you want them to be focused on or what you offer, and not worry about people that aren't attracted to the substance. So
right.
there are some parents that can't get beyond the sizzle, but that's fine. It's their choice. There are some parents, though, that are smarter, that realize the big picture. There's a situation this year with the kid in California that is an ESPN top 60 player and played on a major EYBL team. And I saw him play last weekend in Atop's Fall League. And had a chance to talk to his high school coach afterwards, and the kid's telling me he's got zero high major offers because the team that he played for, he really wasn't able to show what he needed to show to be a valuable high major recruit. So playing in that high circuit per just the nature of play per se didn't help him. He probably would have been his highest offer level wise would have been attained had he played for a non-shoe company team.
Right.
So it doesn't all, it all depends. Not it's no guarantee. And you know, another this year especially with the nature of, you know, the depth of the talent being lower, you have not enough talent, normally high-level talent, for three major circuits going on at once. And then you have this explosion of teams whose dads or coaching teams are having their own deals, which expands the field and dilutes everything. You know, there is a lot of players that I saw more so than ever in the major shoe circuits that were low major or no major players never before, because there's not enough quality players to fill this team, and there's forces at work that interfere with the best players playing with other great players against other great players. So that's the kind of dilemma that we're in right now and the crossroads that we're in from a grassroots standpoint, is we're having the quality of the team competition and how it's presently structured, you know, leaves a lot to be desired. That's why back then, even a few years ago, tournaments like the Real Deal on the Rock and now the Fab 48 are opportunities for to kind of get more of a cross-sampling.
I was going to say, you kind of mentioned kind of the grassroots being at a crossroads, and obviously that last month or so with the FBI reports coming out and, you know, digging into the world of recruiting, and you've been around in it for a while, so I'm sure you have some crazy stories, whether it's recruiting or coaches, their pitches. But how do you kind of see, you know, the waters turning, you know, over the next few months or year in terms of the grassroots scene?
Well, I was talking to a reporter from a paper earlier today, and the two things that are often overlooked here: you're trying to fix a problem without addressing two of the primary points of entering into this problem. Number one is the shoe companies and the NCAA and the relationships they have, and the need for the NCAA to put down or lay out certain guidelines with respect to how those two companies operate in youth basketball from an NCAA standpoint. And the NCAA can't legislate how they totally operate, but they can do it within the confines of the recruiting calendar. Maybe they can specify or to a large degree dictate how event operators, and in many cases these two companies are event operators, how they function and how they're permitted to function in order to have live events. So even though they have it from the event standpoint, they don't have it from the permissible benefit standpoint. We hear the word permissible benefits all the time.
Yep.
Nobody knows what that means. There's no guidelines. You know, if a booster gives a kid $50, it's a violation. But if some kid gets 100 pairs of shoes in 1 week with somebody, I've never heard of a problem like that. So
right.
There's got to be some guidelines instituted from sponsors. And that's because the sponsor in general, what the permissible boundaries are, because that's part of the problem. An even bigger problem is the NBA, its association of players, and the agents involved in the NBA player representation. The NBA has been reluctant or unable to lay down ethical and professional standards for the conduct of the people that represent their players. And not just that, not standard, but also laying down the accountability needed to make them follow those standards. And that's
right.
Why we're having the problem, because we're trying to react to a problem of a kid getting a kid or what would have been alleged that college coaches were being used by these agents and runners to influence certain kids' professional representation. And normally when that book is written by Dan Wetzel, or if it's on a copy, it's the front page of the New York Times or Washington Post or LA Times, the normal response is to penalize some low major kid's ability to be seen by college coaches. They don't want to address the real problem, which affects 1% or less of the playing population. And the NCAA wants to put a Band-Aid or a window dressing over it, where they're not addressing the root of the problem and to identify publicly that the problem here affects 1% of what goes on. And their inability to deal with that 1%, either for legal liability reasons, maybe for PR reasons, maybe they're scared to take on the NBA, maybe they're scared to confront them and to make them a partner in this cleaning up of the game, for lack of a better word, and their ability to take on the shoe companies and to have some type of understanding and agreement with them on how they should behave when it comes to amateur athletes. And that's the problem we have. Unfortunately, what normally happens is they overreact and they penalize the kids who aren't part of the problem. And they clap and they act like they've done something. But the bottom line is, as long as there's money to be made, now there's more money in the NBA than ever before. Whatever these agents are getting, that 2%, 4% of the next mega contract is going to be bigger than ever before. There's going to be a lot of pressure and a lot of interest from people that are going to want to get a piece of that action.
Right.
So unless they're willing to have some standards and to hold those people accountable and say there's something, if you violate these standards, you will no longer be able to represent athletes in our profession, in our association. And on the NCAA side, it's them coming to some kind of fair understanding with the shoe companies and how they're supposed to act in the context of what they do, and which is kind of a difficult proposition because a lot of, obviously, the NCAA is representing, and is an organization representing schools that they have a lot of vested interest by these shoe companies. And it goes back to they don't want to, create waves because you have different scenarios. In the college game, you have major sports paying for the existence of minor sports. If there wasn't an NCAA tournament for basketball, there may not be tournaments for badminton or fencing or girls, softball or, that's the money they're getting to fund all the sports. And the same thing
basically
with the college.
From football and basketball to fund all the other non-revenue.
But even football, that area, what I could tell is the major schools keep most of the money. Basketball is where they're making the money that floats to the other sports because the NCAA creates the contract for the tournament, which I believe is probably bigger than the football is right now as far as the NCAA, the control of the money. Now, on the other hand, these universities are getting resources from the Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, and then that's being used to pay for equipment and expenses for a lot of the other sports. A lot of sports would have to be, they wouldn't be, they'd have to raise the money to pay for their shoes and their uniform. They're getting free uniforms because of basketball and football. Now, they don't want
to bite the hand that feeds them.
That's the situation we're in. So we'll see what this commission comes up with. But obviously, there's going to be a lot of people on that commission that are going to be protecting certain interests in very different elements of the spectrum. and we'll see if they're ready to do it. But there's no simple solution to it. It's a comprehensive problem that needs a comprehensive solution. And the reality is the money at the top is really trickling in to the lower levels because undignified agents are trying to gain an advantage over more established ones by reaching, getting to these kids quicker. And that's part of the problem. And that's why it's coming down to not only to the college, but to the high school level as well, where people are trying to find an advantage. In many cases, that involves a payoff for benefits in order to get an advantage or to create a relationship that they cannot create without the enticement. Because if you don't have a track record of representing clients, you don't have a track record of having clients that have big contracts and producing, how do you overcome that? You have to buy your way in.
Yeah, it'll be interesting just to see, you know, whether it's the FBI and what comes out or how kind of the college season progresses. But yeah, definitely not an easy solution.
FBI situation is a different situation. It's actually kind of a weird, irrelevant situation from the basketball standpoint. What they're accusing these coaches of doing may be unethical, obviously are NCAA problems, but they're not federal criminal problems. Because had those players not been at the college, it would be a professional situation that goes on all the time. And the statute that they're using to charge these coaches is being stretched beyond belief, because based upon my quick reading of what they're trying to nail these college coaches on, it doesn't make any sense. Those statutes were not geared for that type of transaction. They're geared toward mobster transactions, geared for, you know, high-level banking, white-collar criminals. It was not geared to, but what is essentially a referral or ability to act as a consultant to lobby somebody. You know, there's people that they get hired in Washington, D.C. all the time to lobby the U.S. government, whether it's the House of Representatives, senators, president, for certain issues, and they get paid to do so. And,
right.
and the fact of the matter is two of the main criteria that needs to be present for those guys to be guilty of what they're charged is fraud and false pretenses. And which is hilarious, because if everybody was involved in the deal, if the agent knew what he was doing and was okay with it, if the college coach allegedly was okay with it, and the player and or his family member was okay with it, where was the fraud? Who got frauded? did the agent offer to give the kid $100,000 through the coach and then only got $20,000? You know, that doesn't make any sense. Where was their how can they be fraud when they're all in on it together? We're okay with it. And the same token, where's the false pretenses? Who lied to whom? Did the coach think he was getting a different amount from the agents? Did the uncle or the family member or whoever it was involved, did he not get what he thought he was going to get? They were all in on it. There is no fraud. It's an amateurism issue. They have no authority over. They have no authority to enforce the rules of private organizations. The same way the federal government has no authority to enforce state law. It's not their domain. They're not to the authority. So, to me, they would waste resources going after college coaches seems a little far-fetched and a little bit absurd.
Yeah, well, now I see that law school education paying off. But You said something earlier, and you know, whether it's AAU, but you know, recruiting talent, but more so identifying talent. And you run at the beginning of June each year, end of May, you run the Pangos All-American Camp, which brings a little over 100 of the top players in the country out to Southern California to compete against each other. And I guess kind of two questions. Obviously, you bring a lot of the top guys, but you also do a really good job of bringing some of the smaller names out to the camp. So I just, one, curious in terms of your identification, how you go about that. But, and then also, you know, I remember back, I think it was 2012, you brought Ben Simmons to your camp, which was really the first time anybody in the U.S. had seen him play. So I was just kind of curious about your process for identifying talent.
Yeah, there's no exact signs. I obviously have a series of fall camps, a freshman sophomore camp in the fall every year that helps me identify up and coming players. Obviously, you know, national list for people that I respect, whether it's Shane Coleman or Frank Burleson or Eric Bonsier, Jerry Meyer, et cetera. Obviously, I'm keeping track of those. There's a certain local, so I have a certain number of local kids, out of area kids mixed, that's involved for budgetary purposes every year. I try to get a blend of upper class, rising upperclassmen, along with up and coming younger kids that have great potential. I've had eighth graders at the camp before. Tyler Dorsey played as an eighth grader. Steven Zimmerman was an eighth grader. DeAndre Ayton came to the camp as an eighth grader. So there's a number of different factors involved. The Ben Simmons thing, that was a recommendation from his uncle or godfather, David Patrick, who's now with TCU and was with LSU and used to coach with the Houston Rockets. And that kind of transpired. At that point, I think Darius Morris, who played for me, had worked out for the Rockets. And David had called me to give me some feedback on that. And then he said, by the way, I want to let you know I have somebody for you for your camp. He's the best eighth grader in the world. He is from Australia. And I said, well, does he happen to have a name? He goes, yeah, it's my godson, Ben Simmons. Obviously, I didn't know Ben Simmons from Ben Franklin at that point. I was a little skeptical at first, because obviously when you get a family member involved, sometimes the family colored lenses tend to be a little bit more rosy. Not all the time, but in many cases, yeah, than other people. So there's obviously a built-in bias. And some people know how to keep it in check and be honest about it. Other people, it kind of consumes their rationality. So, you know, I got some more information. I couldn't totally tell, you know, how good this kid was. But I've known Dave Petter for a while. Let me give this guy a chance. So, yeah, I remember him coming in to California, the U.S., a couple of days early. And I picked him up at the airport, him and his dad. And we went and had breakfast at a very popular breakfast spot in Long Beach overlooking the marina there called Schooner or later. Remember that breakfast very well, and the kid was very, you know, very well mannered and very polite. I obviously was about 6'7", 6'8" at the time.
Yep.
And then he actually was one of the biggest surprises of the camp. He didn't play that well in the All-Star game. I think he only had 2 points in the All-Star game. We actually filmed on a local TV station that year, and there's some footage there. I remember there's somebody doing a documentary on him that needed some of the footage. I think he may have only had 2 or 4 points in the All-Star game. But for the most part, he played very well, and he made some noise, and a lot of the prep schools were all over him from that point on. And you know, the rest is history. I just saw him last Wednesday in Philadelphia, and he was phenomenal, 6'10", playing the point, initiating offense. He's really
getting the triple-double.
Yeah. His jump shot is not awesome yet. He's still good enough to be effective. So, I mean, I think he's on the verge of being a special player and potential Hall of Famer. All-star.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the stories coming out from that camp at the time I was in Chicago, and definitely that was the first I'd heard of him, and obviously, you know, went on to Monterrey to play extremely well and dominate the summer camps, and play, you know, we see where he's at right now. So I'm gonna try to wrap this up, but just wanted to kind of ask you like a few quick hitters in terms of some of the basketball you've seen. I'd say, who is the best high school player that you've seen
in person? Probably LeBron. Yeah. And in the last, you know, 15 to 20 years, LeBron. The last 30, 40 years, I would put, you know, John Williams from L.A. Crenshaw, who went to LSU and then to the NBA. He was, you know, he had some weight issues, but he was right up there, too. He was a dominant high school player, as I could see going back a little further. So it would probably be LeBron, and John Williams would be up there as well. And trying to think who else, you know, Shea Cotton in his prime was pretty, you know, terrific as well. But LeBron obviously was a guy who had the ability to impact the game in so many ways. It wasn't even funny.
And you had LeBron out for one of your tournaments, right? Back in
I brought his high school team out for my high school single day event back in 2003. I actually had saw one of his mentors earlier here in Las Vegas with Chris Dennis, who actually connected him with Sonny Vaccaro. I saw him today, so he remembers that weekend very well. And obviously his mom being out there, he was just obviously terrific. And actually, what's created the most buzz that we've seen on a national level, excitement wise, and people were just so attracted to his, you know, his demeanor, his all around game, his physical dominance, and his ability to impact the game beyond scoring.
Okay. No, I mean, they played Matter Day, so I definitely remember that, even though I was back in my younger days. But
they played Harrison Shane with the Princeton and Wesley Washington at Oregon State, and actually Taylor King was in the crowd that day as an eighth grader watching.
I know he was quite the big name in high school before going to Duke, and then obviously transferring. Well, in terms of kind of eighth grader, the younger guys, I know you said you just kind of finished up your camps. There's four of them in different parts of the country. Who are some of the top guys we should be on the lookout for over the next few years?
Jalen Green is already on the radar, number one by Rivals and one or two by ESPN. He's terrific. And Patrick Christopher's younger brother, Josh Christopher, who's been on good and high major offers. He's really coming into his own as a big time wing guard. The head coach at Wisconsin Milwaukee, first year, Patrick Baldwin, who used to be at Northwestern as assistant. His son is actually, in many ways, style wise, very similar to Ben Simmons. He came to my camp in Chicago a year ago. He's a 6'4", eighth grader. He's about 6'8" now. Very, very similar as far as all around rebounding, defending, scoring, making the right play, knowing the game, basketball IQ. He might be a top five freshman in the country. Patrick Baldwin Jr. out of Hamilton High School in Milwaukee. He's used to live in Evanston, obviously. In the South, Cade Cunningham is a terrific. RJ Hampton, who's a very nice player, and deserving of his accolades. There's a lot of most of the headlines down there, but I would put Cade Cunningham and Greg Brown definitely his class of player. I mean, they're very, very similar talent-wise. Those guys are just every bit as good, if not better in other ways, than R.J. Hampton. Cade's brother played at SMU, 6'10". He's a 6'6", power wing that can handle it, athletic, strong, big-time body, can really take the ball coast to coast off the dribble, defends very well. Greg Brown from the Austin area is explosive, very athletic. forward that really competes and rebounds and, you know, finishes around the rim with authority. Moody.
Okay.
He's with schools right now. Moses Moody, I'm sorry. 6'5", like a Ray Allen type guard. Can really defend. He's got a really smooth stroke. You know, Frank Burleson said, compared to young Ray Allen, he's at North Little Rock now. He came to my camp last year as a freshman and played very, very well. He's one of the most underrated national guys. He's a top 25 caliber guy in that class as well. And then in New York, we had Posh Alexander.
Yep.
Who's one of a very, very speedy point guard at New York.
Explosive as well.
Explosive, and he's very, very good. Elijah Hutchins Everett from North Jersey is a big body post forward that gets a lot of stuff done. Maximilian Amasudun from our Xavier, I believe, up in New York. He's like a Montrezl Harrell type power forward that's a terrific rebound with high motor. Tons of other guys that have slipped in my memory at the time, at this time. But it was, so we had other 800 kids, about 200 each camp. And it was kind of a good glimpse at the future and kind of very excited about the future of the younger levels coming up. And actually this year at the South Camp in Dallas, we tried something different, which turned out to be really good. You know, obviously one of the things recently that I've seen a problem with is the competitiveness of these players and how hard they go at each other. And a lot of these guys will prefer to be friendly all the time rather than be competitors or rivals. And it just happened to be by coincidence this year that the top 30 kids picked for the top All-Star game in Dallas happened to be 15 guys from Texas and 15 guys from everywhere else, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, Tennessee. So I forgot who it was. Somebody came up with the idea, let's have a Texas versus everybody else game.
Yep.
First, I didn't know what to think about it, and we kind of went with it. And to my surprise, pleasant surprise, it was the most hard-fought All-Star game I've ever seen. And from the coaches really coaching like it was Game 7 to the players playing like it was Game 7 to the players on the bench getting up and cheering for the players that were playing, from the parents in the stands that were going crazy and going nuts. You know, it was 35-35 at halftime. Every time somebody got the ball, it was a hard foul. You know, they really defended like I've never seen in an All-Star game. And they took a pride in where they were from or what they were representing. And it actually turned out to be a pleasant surprise. They really, I have never seen anything like it. So sometimes when you get that competitive,
it brings out the best in everyone.
It brings out the best. Even though there was one team that had to lose, Van Coleman immediately after the game went up to that team and told them how proud he was and how they were not losers. They were winners in his eyes. So it was a good competitive, a good thing to see because I've been noticing recently. There's a lot of these kids, they don't compete like years past.
All right. Well, I've definitely enjoyed this discussion, but last question for you. If you had to watch a game, a basketball game anywhere, whether it's a playground or a gym, what's your favorite spot to watch a game?
That's a tough question. So many unique spots. Obviously, Cameron Indoor Stadium is a nice special place. I've been to the Dean Dome. I've been to an NCAA Final Four. Whether it's AT&T Stadium, which is terrific last year, with Oregon going to the Final Four, I had really good seats in the second row at the Phoenix Glendale Stadium. You know, something. The one thing I really like, the Vanderbilt. They had a very unique arena. I forgot what it's called.
Sure.
With the four.
The benches behind the baskets.
Yeah, bats behind the bat had a really, a very unique feel to it. They had the four rows up to that was a very stiff or unique. Obviously, Kentucky Rough Arena is nice. It has a tremendous feel to it. So many, it's hard to put into one. And obviously, the NBA arenas too, from the old ones to the newer ones that are really nice. The Madison Square Garden is nice.
Yeah, I mean, you've obviously been, you know, seen a lot. So I was just curious about that, but.
Yeah,
McHale
Center in Arizona, they have good electricity
yep.
there. Obviously, UCLA has got a lot of history in that gym as well. So,
well, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and talking about your basketball journey. It's obviously extremely interesting and fascinating, you know, how you got started and everything you've been able to accomplish. And I'm sure the stories you've seen and could tell, you could write a few books on those. But thanks a lot for coming on and looking forward to seeing you through some of the high school events coming up.
Okay, appreciate you having me on.